Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is critic, scholar, performer, author, and music historian, Ted Gioia. And we're talking about his monumental new book, Music, A Subversive History. Ted, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you for having me on as a guest.
I do not hesitate to call this a magnum opus. This is like the work of a lifetime. How many years is this in the making?
Well, you know, I can tell by going back to my journals that I started doing the research that led to my new book in the early 1990s, going back to 1991. So it's scary for me to think that I spent more than a quarter of a century on a single project, but it's a complicated project. I'm trying to tell the story of all music and tell it in a way no one's told it before. So that required a little bit of time investment.
Well, what's interesting is you start out the book by writing, well, music history is basically boring and sort of filled with ennui. And this was the antidote. You wrote the antidote to that.
When I tell people that I've written about music in a way that other people haven't, and I've uncovered some things that are very important that were left out of music history books, they say, well, how can that be so? How can it be the case that these other books don't cover it? And I said, well, it's because it's embarrassing. It's because it's shameful.
Right.
Because what I found during the course of my research is that the engine of innovation in music is linked to very embarrassing things: sex, violence, altered mind states, magic, supernatural rituals, social upheaval, generational conflict. And these are precisely the things that most music history books leave out because they always want their subject to be respectable. And probably the first thing I learned is that the real history of music isn't respectable.
That's right.
The exact opposite.
And much of that history has been erased. You've really had to piece together different elements. I mean, I get the sense from reading your book that you would come across something in reading and you go, ha, that fits into this narrative that I'm going to write. That's why it took a quarter of a century.
Well, I have an approach to writing that's probably different than most in that I start things with a complete open mind and I'm not even sure what I'm going to write about. I take a topic that interests me, and it's surprising. Probably half the books I've written turned out very differently from what I anticipated. And this is definitely a situation like that. I had no idea what I was going to find. My original impetus was a very simple one. I thought that I wanted to tell the story of music as a way of changing people's lives. So it's very simple. I thought music was life-changing.
It is.
And I wanted to, and I felt that, you know, this is the part that's once again left out of the music history books. We talk about music and we look at the people that play on Carnegie Hall stage or the rock bands in the big auditorium or the superstars or the musicians that play for the king or queen. And I was wondering, what is music like for ordinary people? And it was really when I got into that, that's when I found all these extraordinary things I didn't expect. And so it's often the case, and as you mentioned, that it's the gaps in the music history that became the most interesting one. Let me give you just one example. During the first 1,000 years of Christianity, virtually no secular songs survive in the vernacular language. So this would be songs that...
I remember reading this, and my jaw dropped.
You know, we don't have any. We know about...
But I never even considered it. I never even thought about that.
But in terms of what songs people sang in their everyday life, none of it's preserved. So should we assume that these songs didn't exist? Well, in fact, we know they existed,
mm-hmm.
and we know they were important, and we know that because of how often they were attacked. We have so many attacks that are survived. These, like, sermons. A priest would get up there and complain about the songs the people in the village were singing. Or church council would put out a statement saying, people have to stop singing all these dirty songs. Or the Pope would issue a statement. Or even Charlemagne, the emperor, would issue a statement. We've got to stop all these songs. And this is what I found were the most interesting parts of music history. This is left out of the books because the songs themselves haven't survived. But what you find is if you pay very close attention to these attacks, you can reconstruct the musical life pretty well. And to me, this is what was the fascinating part of music history, is there's these gaps and silences in the traditional books, and I was trying to fill them in.
Let's just give an example, and just one of many from this book. And I want to mention that we're not going to do the book justice in this half hour. There's a rupture in Western music that comes out into the open during the ancient Greek period. It's the time of philosophers like Pythagoras and Plato. And from that point, there's this sort of people trying to divide up what's the good music from what's the bad music.
Well, this is a very interesting situation. You go back into ancient times, and I claim in my book that the most important person in the history of music is someone who actually didn't compose any songs himself, and we'd really know very little about, but his name is Pythagoras. Most of us, if we know Pythagoras, it's because of high school geometry. We had to learn the Pythagorean theorem, and then if you're like me, you try to forget it as soon as possible, as soon as the term was over. But Pythagoras was the person who came up with this amazing idea that music was just mathematics, and that every note needed to be in tune, every note had to belong to a scale, and the scale and being in tune were determined by mathematical ratios. Now, we just take this for granted now. I mean, you go to the symphony orchestra, the first thing they do is tune up. And none of us question that. We just assume, yeah, the first thing musicians do is tune up. But, you know, before Pythagoras, and in many parts of the world until very recent times, that didn't happen. I mean, there's a whole African paradigm of music, which is all about sound. And you don't tune up. You can use any sound. The idea that you could only use the notes in a scale, a traditional African musician would have laughed at that as being ridiculously restricting. So this is one example of this rupture that enters into musical life, which keeps reappearing
right,
century after century. And you can define it in many different ways. Well, even today, you could say there's a conflict between music as mathematics as an algorithm, because that's what we're taught now. The streaming services are going to have algorithms to pick our musical life, or the messier way music is actually discovered in real life.
But it even got down to the musical instruments. It became the lyre versus the aulos.
Well, that's right. You see, you find this again and again in music history. There are certain instruments that are considered too dangerous. And they change. In our lifetime, it was the electric guitar. That was what everybody feared. The parents feared it. The religious institutions feared it. If you go back to an earlier day, the 1930s, 1940s, it was the saxophone.
That's right.
I'm told that there were certain radios. I don't know if this is true, but I've been told that there were certain radio stations in the heartland that would not play a song with a saxophone on the Sabbath.
Too sexual.
So, you know, it's Sunday, no sax albums. You go back to ancient Greece, though, the instrument they feared was the flute.
Yeah.
And this strikes us as ridiculous nowadays, because what could be more prim and proper than a flute? But this has always been the case, that certain instruments are considered dangerous and have to be censored and repressed, and other ones are upheld as the right kinds of instruments that create order in society and please the authorities. And once again, if you want to write the history of music, you've got to go find what were these instruments that no one wanted you to hear? Because this is the fascinating stuff, and like I say, it's written out of the history books, and once you learn what the forbidden stuff is, it's only then that you begin to understand where real innovations come in music history.
Well, you follow this through and research it, and it ends up this flute versus lyre thing breaks down into sexes, male versus female, masculine versus feminine, and then it even gets more abstract as the sort of Apollonian versus Dionysian. So it becomes it really sort of sorting out to like what makes you really wild and crazy versus this is the proper music you should be listening to.
And this is another example of something I had no idea about before I started the research. But I soon found that there were these dangerous sounds, and they were always associated with women.
Right.
You know, if you go back to these church councils in the medieval period where the church would say, hey, we got to stop these dirty songs. And they would almost always say the dirty songs that the women are singing. They would always specify it's the women in the village that are singing these dirty songs. And we've got to suppress them. What were these songs like? And it's funny, you go back into ancient Greece, it was the same thing. They were very worried about the lament, the songs women would sing when someone in their household died. Now, why would they worry about the lament? What you eventually figure out when you put together the pieces, what scared these people were songs of personal expression.
Right.
It was those strong personal emotions. And eventually I figured out that music has been a powerful source in the advancement of personal autonomy, human freedom, and civil rights, because the first sign that you're going to defend your rights is you begin singing about your feelings. And so there's this long history, once again, it's almost completely written out of the music history books, of people singing about their personal expressions. Now, here's something I found out that no one had shown this before. The very first songs of personal expression that have ever been recorded in history, these go back 3,000 years ago to ancient Greece, to a village called Deir el-Medina.
Mm.
And we have the songs, they're written down, they've actually survived. This is the same village that created the first labor strike in history. Is this mere coincidence? Well, it might seem to be, but once you go through all the evidence in my book, you understand that it should not be surprising at all that people start singing about their feelings and they start making political demands. So it's a fascinating connection that's recurred through the history of music, even into, hey, the current day, the songs used in the Hong Kong protests. I was told last week that protesters in Lebanon are using the Baby Shark song as a
that's
protest
right.
anthem.
That's right.
So these things haven't changed. They recur over and over again because this is the power of music.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is critic, scholar, performer, author, and music historian Ted Gioia. And we're talking about his monumental book, Music, A Subversive History. It's much more fun than any history that you've probably ever read. Much more interesting, too. One of the other things that keeps popping up throughout your book is the role of the music of the peoples who are enslaved, that how that becomes their music infiltrates the people who are enslaving them and acts as change agents within musical traditions.
Now, this is another pattern that surprised me. Now, we know from our own lifetime how important innovations in black music
have
been to revitalizing the whole music scene. And the whole 20th century was this emergence of sort of an Africanized music. Like I say, it defied the Pythagorean notion that everything had to be in tune. You know, the blues notes would bend the notes, and the jazz horns would distort the tones. And this was all music made by the descendants of slaves. And so it's a puzzle at first glance, is how are the people at the very bottom of the social hierarchy, the most discriminated against, impoverished, and despised group in the United States, why are they the music innovators? And the surprising thing is then when you look at history, you find the same thing has happened. You know, in the medieval period, the great birth of the Western love song was anticipated by these female slave singers in the Muslim world. You go back to ancient Rome, where the greatest musical performers were often slaves. And then this is the most puzzling part of all. In ancient Greece, you had these slave musicians, and their names are enshrined in our terminology nowadays. If you're a music student, the first thing you learn are the musical modes. These are the basic scales every musician has to learn. They have names, the Phrygian mode, the Lydian mode. But what no one tells you is the Phrygians and Lydians were the nationalities of the Greek slaves. And so there's a recurring pattern, and at a certain point you begin to understand that the slave is the innovator because as outsider, the slave is willing to disrupt the status quo. The slave has no vested interest in preserving the power structure. So it's not surprising that disruptive music would always come from the slave population. And once again, once you understand this correlation, you begin seeing things in the course of music history that other historians would have missed because they don't understand how this dynamic plays out.
There are so many sections of your book that I just became sort of, I wanted to read more about. One of them is about the rise of the troubadours. Here we have a time where the church is banning music or restricting music. And then you have this traveling group of singers who are changing a lot of things about the way people enjoy music. Just from the fact that individual singers are now known by name is a huge change up in music at that time.
Well, this is one of the great transformations in music history because for 1,000 years you weren't allowed to sing about yourself. You could sing about God, you could sing about country, you could sing about the king and queen, but if you sang about yourself and your own personal feelings, this was a sin. and it was condemned by all the authorities. And then all of a sudden, this changes. It changes, and all of a sudden, in the late medieval period, it changes in the south of France, Provence. And it's the nobility, it's the dukes and the lords and the ladies. All of a sudden, they're excited about this new way of singing about love and personal emotion. But here again, the whole history books leave out the most fascinating part of the story. Now, I remember doing all this research into the troubadours, and I had like this shelf full of books, 30, 40 books on the troubadours, and I'm going through them trying to figure out what's going on here. And then just as a sideline, I start studying these female slave singers in the Muslim world. And I found that 200 years before the troubadours, these female singers in the Muslim world were singing exactly the same kind of songs.
Right.
And then I saw the process of dissemination. Because as you, if you know your history, you know, Islam took over Spain and Portugal for hundreds of years with the conquest of the Iberian Peninsula. And literally it's a one-day journey on horse from there to Provence where these nobles were. And these nobles had gone into Spain. They had taken back these slave singers. And this is where they learned the Western love song. And it's never been written about before. And it explains a great mystery.
It's also creating a total change in music. There's the invention of the audience. And people are going, I'm sure people listening are going, what? There was always an audience for music. There wasn't always an audience as we define it. And it had to start someplace.
You know, I remember getting in an argument with another music writer. And he said, Ted, every music's written for the audience. Said, that's not true. And I said, no. So even if they won't say it, the musicians are always playing for the audience. And then I gave like 10 or 20 examples where I challenged this. I said, okay, 100 years ago, you're a peasant at a wedding feast in Eastern Europe, and everybody is dancing at the wedding reception to the band. Who's the audience? Well, these dancers are actually participating
right
in the music. When I go to church and we all get up and we sing, who's the is God the audience? It makes no sense to talk about an audience there. If you go to most traditional cultures, this is especially true in Africa, some of them don't even have a word for audience. Because everybody participates when they get together in the community to make music, everybody participates in it. And even today, you know, I was singing in the shower this morning. And who's the audience? I mean, so the idea that the audience is always there is a relatively new idea, and it's now become dominant in Western culture. And this is the amazing thing about it: is the audience gets to decide whether the music is good or bad. But we should not ignore for one moment what a radical notion that is. And how much that shook things up when that was first admitted.
When entertainers now performed for the enjoyment of the listener, they're playing to the audience. And as you quote from your book, it's enjoyment-driven aesthetics.
Well, that's right. And you imagine how threatening this is to the authorities.
Oh, yeah.
You know, previously you sang for the king or for God or for a country or as part of your military unit going into battle. And the music instilled authority and discipline, and now everybody's singing for the audience, the rabble. You know, in Rome, everybody knew that there was an audience for some of these musical entertainments, but the audience was despised. And the idea that if you wrote your music for them, that was an indicator that you were not operating at the highest level. So we've completely flip-flopped now. Nowadays, we understand that if you want to reach the highest rung in music, you play for the audience. But like I say, we shouldn't ignore for a second what an extraordinary idea this is and forget that for most of human history, that was not the case.
I'm going to zip forward to the end of the book just because I want to talk about it, and we have like minutes left. But there's such an acceleration in your writing, in your emotions about the last, say, four or five chapters because it's that time, like from the 50s through to literally right up to today. A lot of things happen. Technology makes rapid changes, and as you bring up time and again, that changes the way music is appreciated, is listened to, and is produced. And it's the rise of corporate music. MTV, the CD, Silicon Valley have more and more influence on our music. And yet still, still this Dionysian impulse of music and musicians. And how is that manifested?
Well, we're told right now that we've reached this happily ever after period in music history, that streaming platforms like Spotify and Apple Music are going to use artificial intelligence, and they're going to pick the perfect song for every moment in our day.
Oh, I hate this.
And we don't need to worry about anything. We'll live in this perfectly controlled musical environment. Now, what I have to tell people is this is not going to happen. And I know it's not going to happen because there have been previous times when the music business thought this. You know, you go back to the early 1950s. The music business thought they had it all figured out. They had invented the long-playing album, and they invented mood music. They had these mood music albums. They invented this thing called the Bachelor Pad album.
I have some of those.
Play this album. And there were these romantic ballads sung by Sinatra, which had wide appeal. Everybody loved these songs. They had these novelty songs that were amusing. And the music industry said, we got to figure it out. We've got all the answers. And then 5 years later, rock and roll showed up and completely disrupted everything. And the reason for this is because there are two things I show in my book. Is that musical innovation is disruptive, and two, people crave that disruption. They want that disruption. So the same thing happened in the 1970s. It started with the gentle singer-songwriters. By the end of the decade, you had punk rock and disco. It was very disruptive. I'm saying the same thing's happening right now. We think we're in a period of happy ever after where our musical life is completely controlled. I'm telling you, based on the lessons of history, that won't be the case. There'll be a new disruption coming, and probably from an outsider or from some very unexpected source.
But you look at celebrations like Burning Man, and you mentioned this in the book, and it's hard not to see a parallel between the electronic dance music that's there and sort of Dionysian rites back in ancient Greece.
Well, all the current day musical genres have their antecedents in ancient history.
Yep.
The rave is the most striking example of it. You know, in ancient times, people would get into these musical rituals, and they would use it as a transformative path to ecstasy. The drums would take them into an out-of-body experience. Today at the rave, they call the drug ecstasy. It's actually the name of the little pill you're supposed to take when you listen to this music. It's no different than what the ancient Greeks did with their musical rituals. So, and you could make a case. I mean, there's a certain case I make in my book, which is a little bit outrageous, but also true, that back in ancient times, there was the music of the hunters and the music of the herders. And today, that they're the very same social purposes and dynamics are echoed in rock music and country music. Rock is the music of the primitive hunter. The herder is the person who stayed at home, and that's the person that stayed back in rural America and then in country music. So even when we think everything has changed, it's the same patterns that recur over and over again.
Some of it has a really dark side, too, that you mentioned. This sort of sacrificial imperative. And one of the key figures you talk about is Sid Vicious.
Well, that's right. You know, I there's a philosopher named Rene Girard who talks about social events as sacrificial rituals. And he's got this whole theory of people go to these things. They think it's entertainment, but there's actually a sacrificial ritual at work there. Now, Girard doesn't mention music at all. He doesn't even know about music. He's looking at plays and whatever. But he wrote this during the rise of rock and roll, and you can apply this whole theory to not only rock and roll, but much of my book shows these violent rituals are transformed into musical performances.
Right.
And so in rock and roll, you would actually, sometimes it would actually be violence at the concert, like at the Sex Pistols at Winterland or Altamont. At other points, the musician would destroy the musical instrument.
You know, Pete Townsend and Jimi Hendrix.
You know. And then at a minimum, if you were a rock star, you were expected to go back and destroy your hotel room. I mean, that was, you know, if you didn't trash your hotel room, you weren't a real rock star.
By the way, I just want to mention that started in the Renaissance, as you mentioned in your book. Musical personages acting badly really became a thing in the early Renaissance.
That's right. And we expect the musician to do this, and we admire, even though we won't admit this, we admire the musician more because they've trashed their hotel room. And people say, Ted, can you really call musical concerts sacrificial rituals? And I say, they don't call it Burning Man for nothing. You know, I mean, they even burn an effigy of a man. You couldn't get a better example of how popular music evokes a sacrificial ritual.
One of the things, and I have to make this quick, that I love that you just reamed, were TV song shows. Like American Idol and The Masked Singer, as being sort of the most commodified and corporate music entertainments that we can have.
Well, it would be funny if it wasn't so pathetic, but I show at the end of my book how the music industry just fell asleep and they let Silicon Valley take over everything.
Yeah.
So now the most powerful companies in music aren't music companies. They're Apple, they're Google. And if you look and you ask, well, what did the music industry do during this period of disruption? Well, the biggest innovation was the TV singing reality show contest.
Oh, you know? My God.
It's like, okay, Apple's going to take over all music, but we'll respond with American Idol. And so it's there's a certain pathos about this, but it shows you how even the people that run the music industry often don't understand the changes that are happening at their very doorstep.
This is an amazing book, and it goes so many different places. It's a little bit mind-boggling. You feel like you're shot out of a cannon reading it, going through history. And you want to be there at every moment in history and experience the music and the events that you talked about, too. It's an outstanding book, Ted. My guest tonight has been critic, scholar, performer, author, music historian Ted Gioia, and he's written just an outstanding history. Music, a Subversive History. Ted, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me back on.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.